Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results, made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less. Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is an iHeart Original.
I used to go to the store at noontime, and they'd be sitting there playing checkers. You wouldn't hear a sound there. Everybody was talking with their hands.
It didn't stop at checkers. This was a place where you could work, gossip with your neighbors, shop for supplies, or play a cutthroat game of cards, all without saying a word.
When a boat was coming in, they'd go out on the dock, and everybody knew just how much fish they'd caught, what they caught, and everything. And you'd wonder why they had all the information before they got ashore.
This place was called Chilmark. It's a village on Martha's Vineyard, tucked away between rolling hills and the slate-blue Atlantic Ocean. Chilmark is still around today. It's one of the island's six small towns. It's always been a small town. The difference is, years ago, many of Chilmark's residents were deaf. These were farmers, fishermen, husbands, wives, normal everyday folks.
They weren't your deaf neighbors or your deaf friends. They were just your friends who happened to be deaf, like your other friend across the way happened to be tall or to be blue-eyed.
So a sign language developed, Martha's Vineyard Sign Language. Everybody used it, deaf people and hearing people.
We didn't think anything of it. It was just accepted.
But by the 1950s, this way of communicating in Chilmark was gone. Few remembered sign language was once the village lingua franca. It seemed to have disappeared without a trace. Until one day, with the assist of a very helpful great-grandmother, it was rediscovered.
What signs do I remember? Remember snow, girl, lie, truth, shoot. Dog. I remember quite a lot.
Welcome to Very Special Episodes, an iHeart Original podcast. I'm your host, Dana Schwartz, and this is I Remember All the Signs. The evolution of language is something that has been fascinating to me for a long time. And so this deep dive in this episode, it hit all of my buttons. I love this type of story so much.
I love stories that involve people connecting with their grandparents, and then that somehow moves our understanding of the world around. Go talk to your grandparents. You may end up in a future episode.
Completely. Call them, talk to them. Oh my God, yes. Also, what about the secret language aspect?
Oh,
having a secret language with a grandparent? Come on now.
A secret language with your grandparents? It's giving wholesome. It's giving sweet. It's giving Grandparents Day.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
So when I was 7 years old in second grade, I was reading a book inside my desk.
This is Joan Poole Nash. She grew up around Chilmark in the 1960s.
It was about Helen Keller. And when I got to the end of the book, they gave the fingerspelling alphabet. So I spent the afternoon teaching myself to fingerspell. God knows what was going on in second grade, but nothing exciting.
Joan didn't know what she was doing was a form of sign language. She was just passing the time. And she was excited to show off her new skill.
After school, I walked by my great-grandmother's house and I showed her the alphabet that I'd taught myself.
To Joan's surprise, her great-grandmother, Emily Poole, already seemed to know fingerspelling. And she knew more than that, too. She knew signs. Signs that weren't in that Helen Keller book.
And she said, "Oh, I know that one-handed alphabet, and I know the two-handed alphabet, and I know all the signs." She immediately started teaching me signs, and they became a secret language between the two of us.
Joan was just a little girl, and she didn't realize what her great-grandmother was teaching her. She didn't think it was a sign language for deaf people. After all, she didn't see any deaf people using it. Joan figured her great-grandmother must have picked it up elsewhere.
I thought, in the back of my brother's Boy Scout book, there's a book of Indian signs. So that must be it. She knows those from when she ran the Boy Scout troop.
But it didn't really matter that she didn't know what it was called. Joan was hooked on sign. And as she grew older, she expanded her knowledge. She learned American Sign Language, or ASL, and even decided to study ASL at school.
I went to Boston University, and people were just then starting to look at sign languages as real languages and not just made-up gestures.
This was a pretty new approach. At this time, in the 1970s, many people didn't take sign languages very seriously. They didn't consider that they might have their own distinct grammars or vocabularies, and that sign languages, like all living languages, grow and evolve. It was this last point that the academics around Joan were focused on. And early on in her studies, while in discussion with some older students, she had a revelation.
The thing that they were most interested in at that point was how the sign language that people use now clearly had been different at some time. And as I was listening to them, I realized the signs that they were using as old signs were the signs that my great-grandmother used. And so I knew where those signs came from. They came from Martha's Vineyard.
So those weren't Boy Scout signs after all. But why would her great-grandmother know those old signs? Joan called up Emily, who was by then in her 90s, and asked. Her reply? Because all these people were deaf.
It turned out that my great-grandmother knew over 300 signs.
It wasn't an answer Joan was expecting to hear, but she knew she needed to learn more. So Joan and other linguists went to Martha's Vineyard. They brought along their video recording equipment and spent hours and hours with the older Chilmark residents, asking questions. What did they remember about the deaf people who had once lived there? And what about this sign language they all seem to know?
Everybody in my grandfather's generation learned to sign. And they learned to sign well, even if they thought they didn't. We'd be interviewing them and they'd say, "Oh yeah, I don't remember the sign for horse," but, and you'd look at them like, "Horse, you showed it to me," you know.
To these older generations, sign language was second nature, part of the experience of living in Chilmark, like fishing for striped bass or raking clams or taking a dip at Moshup Beach.
None of the people that I videotaped had thought that anything was unique about hearing people using sign language.
Joan had stumbled upon something, a place where hearing people and deaf people alike communicated with one another as neighbors, as equals. But why Chilmark?
Tired of hair removal tools that just don't cut it? Conair Girl Bomb gives you smooth, flawless results while putting you firmly in control. From achieving that silky smooth skin to boosting your inner confidence, Conair Girl Bomb is all about helping you elevate your self-care game. Whether it's creating a hype playlist, throwing yourself into a hobby, or scheduling some me time, self-care is important to keeping you feeling confident and empowered. It's time to take your hair removal routine to the next level. You can trust Conair Girl Bomb to get the job done right. Conair Girl Bomb gives you the secret weapons for achieving powerful results with ease. Designed with women in mind, these tools boast the Sassy Girl Bomb Grip for unparalleled handling and precision, along with professional-grade blades to deliver results that you used to only get from men's tools. No more compromising. So, to all you incredible women out there, treat yourself to a little Conair Girl Bomb magic. Don't settle for anything less than perfection. Elevate your grooming game with Conair Girl Bomb. Available now at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've never been to Martha's Vineyard, you may have heard about it as a tourist spot. Secluded beaches, quaint towns, sandy bike trails, fresh seafood everywhere. Its year-round population is around 23,000. In the summer, it grows to 200,000. The Obamas, David Letterman, Spike Lee, they all vacation there. But about 200 years ago, it was pretty quiet, pretty rural, and very remote. There weren't many visitors at all, let alone celebrity visitors. Chilmark, located on the southwestern part of the island, was especially secluded.
Chilmark in the 19th century was a relatively tiny cluster of buildings, a couple of churches, a town hall, a general store or two, over the span of maybe a quarter mile or a half a mile of country road. It wasn't the end of the world, but you could see it from there.
This is Bo Van Riper. He's the research librarian at the Martha's Vineyard Museum. He and other historians have been working with Joan to learn more about the islands, and specifically Chilmark's, history of sign language.
One of the great ironies of studying the Chilmark deaf community is the thing that makes it remarkable, that people saw deafness just as another way of being human, means that the official records rarely consistently point out people's deafness as a way of describing them. It might have been that George or Bob was deaf, but that everybody was so used to that that it wouldn't have occurred to them to mention the fact.
Deafness can happen for a variety of reasons, like from complications during pregnancy or a childhood infection. But on Martha's Vineyard, it was because of genetics. Some of the early white settlers, especially the ones who ended up near Chilmark, carried the gene for hereditary deafness. At first, it was just a couple of people.
It's worth noting that for most of the 18th century, the number of deaf people on the vineyard was extremely small. You could probably have counted them at any point on the fingers of one hand with your thumb left over.
But over time, the deaf population grew. Bo estimates that at its peak in the mid-19th century, the deaf population on the island was no more than 50 people. But when towns are so small, that's still a sizable percentage.
The figure that you often see quoted is one in every five Chilmarkers was deaf at a time when the incidence on the mainland was something like one in several thousands.
And on the mainland, the deaf population was often treated much, much differently. During this time, deafness was commonly seen as a, quote, defect, and often linked with insanity. At best, deaf people were viewed as other. At worst, they were ostracized. Even people who studied deafness and taught deaf students, people like the inventor of the telephone, Alexander Graham Bell, thought the ultimate goal for all deaf people should be complete assimilation into hearing society. God forbid anyone know you're deaf. Bell believed in a method called oralism, which values spoken language over other forms, meaning the deaf should learn how to read lips and speak aloud. Some even thought sign language should be banned altogether. But in a way, Chilmark's isolation saved it from this narrow-minded thinking. Oralism didn't cross anyone's mind because it didn't make any sense. So many community members were deaf, brothers, husbands, daughters, neighbors, that using sign language was the simplest way for everyone to live and work together.
If you were on the porch of the Chilmark General Store in, say, the middle of the 19th century, likely what you'd see would be people, if they were hearing, engaged in conversation with their neighbors, and they'd be simultaneously speaking aloud to their hearing neighbors and signing the conversation for their deaf neighbors.
At church, a hearing person would automatically sign the sermon. At a town meeting, someone would sign the agenda, so both deaf and hearing residents knew when to signal their votes. Neither hearing nor deaf people would be shut out of any given conversation. All could participate.
As far as we know, in Chilmark, in the 19th century into the 20th century, the deaf were, from an economic, political, social point of view, fully integrated members of the community. They voted in town meetings. They held positions of respect and authority. There was no social distinction between deaf and hearing. Having a deaf person look after your children or marry your son or your daughter or be your business partner, your neighbor, your pew mate in church was a completely unremarkable thing.
We don't know exactly when Martha's Vineyard Sign Language first started, but we do know who started it, the deaf residents in and near Chilmark. And because of that, it was specific to life on a small island. For example, its focus on fish.
Being able to distinguish between multiple species of fish and being able to have different signs for the fish that's sitting on your dinner plate as opposed to the fish that you're trying to catch is only useful if you make your living fishing and if most of the people you live and work with also make their living fishing.
Swordfish, cod, scallop, they all had their own signs. Signs that don't exist in modern-day standard ASL, or at least look very different.
Anybody who's ever seen a scallop swimming underwater will instantly recognize why that's the sign for scallop, because that's what a scallop looks like. Anybody who's seen a swordfish swimming with its sharp dorsal fin and sharp tail fin poking out of the water, as most Chilmarkers would instantly recognize, oh yes, of course, that's swordfish.
There were other unique signs too. As Joan continued her research, she was especially delighted to find one in particular.
So the sign for cranberry is just very important to me because no one uses it anywhere else except here. On the mainland, there is no sign for cranberry. And so I make it important. Everyone who I teach sign language to, I always show them the sign for cranberry.
Here, Joan makes the sign, curling the fingers of her left hand into a loose fist, her thumb on top. With her other thumb and index finger, she flicks at the left thumb like you might a marble.
It's just your thumb flicking the cranberry off the little bush in the water and gathering them up.
Tailoring the language to the community meant that the people who use it, the people of Chilmark, had signs for themselves too.
They had a sign for most everybody, for the person.
That's Eric Cottle. He grew up around Chilmark when the deaf community was still a notable presence. Before he passed away in 2010 at the age of 92, Eric was interviewed by the Martha's Vineyard Museum as part of its oral history project.
Now, Philippi lost his hand in a threshing machine when he was young, so that you know that was Benny Mayo.
As he talks, Eric makes a sign, chopping off his right hand with his left.
And Ernest Mayo, his was here.
Now he's hitting his forehead with a flat hand, almost saluting.
They used to hang May baskets. And he run into somebody's clothesline, but then it broke his neck. They hit him right across there, so that was a sign for Ernest Mayo.
Sign language was so ingrained in life in Chilmark that it wasn't limited to use only when a deaf person was present. As Bo points out, hearing people in Chilmark understood that in many circumstances, signing was the preferred method of communication.
There are stories about farmers who, when they were out in the field and their wife, say, wanted to pass them some message, bring us and such when you come in for supper, they bang on a pot or a bell to get the farmer's attention. And then rather than hollering across the open field, they'd sign their request and he'd sign back.
And this was even more effective for the town's fishermen out on the water.
Once people started using internal combustion engines rather than sails, one of the problems they ran up against was that the engines were incredibly deafeningly loud. And so if your engine was running, it was far easier to just sign, hey, how's the fishing today? Or are there any cod over there by the buoy or whatever, than to try and get close enough to holler over the sound of the engine or turn off the engine and then have to get it started again.
Joan's father, Everett Poole, was also interviewed by the Martha's Vineyard Museum before he passed away. And he, too, remembered his own father, a hearing man, signing with other men out on the boats.
I'd be fishing with my father. We'd pull up alongside of another boat. And in those days, we had these damned old noisy Lathrop engines. You couldn't hear yourself think, you know. And they'd pull up alongside it. My father just talked to the guy with his fingers, you know. He didn't bother to shout at all.
There were other unexpected benefits to knowing how to sign, like during cutthroat card games with neighboring towns that didn't know sign language.
I remember all the signs. That was diamonds. That was clubs. That was hearts. That was spades.
That's Eric Cottle again.
So we cheat. We'd give each other signs.
Here, Eric taps his chest.
He knew I had hearts. We were bad.
Tired of hair removal tools that just don't cut it? Conair Girl Bomb gives you smooth, flawless results while putting you firmly in control. From achieving that silky smooth skin to boosting your inner confidence, Conair Girl Bomb is all about helping you elevate your self-care game. Whether it's creating a hype playlist, throwing yourself into a hobby, or scheduling some me time, self-care is important to keeping you feeling confident and empowered. It's time to take your hair removal routine to the next level. You can trust Conair Girl Bomb to get the job done right. Conair Girl Bomb gives you the secret weapons for achieving powerful results with ease. Designed with women in mind, these tools boast the Sassy Girl Bomb Grip for unparalleled handling and precision, along with professional-grade blades to deliver results that you used to only get from men's tools. No more compromising. So, to all you incredible women out there, treat yourself to a little Conair Girl Bomb magic. Don't settle for anything less than perfection. Elevate your grooming game with Conair Girl Bomb. Available now at ConairGirlBomb.com or a retailer near you.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Martha's Vineyard Sign Language was a robust and complex language. For years, it was a specific and completely normal part of life for its users. But the idea of a special sign language that arises to fit the needs of a community is not, in fact, unique to Chilmark. Villages in Ghana, Mexico, India, Turkey, Japan, and Indonesia also have their own sign languages, used by deaf and hearing residents alike. Like Chilmark, these communities are often quite small. And like Chilmark was once, they are often quite isolated. In fact, it was that change, becoming less isolated, that ushered in the demise of Martha's Vineyard Sign Language.
By, say, 1850, several things are coming together that change the way deafness happened on the island and that change the experience of the Chilmark deaf.
That's Bo Van Riper again.
One was that as transportation technology improved, as steamboats replaced sail ferries and steamboats became themselves more reliable, it became easier for people to go back and forth to the mainland, which made it more likely that Chilmarkers would meet and become friendly with and potentially marry and have children with people from off the island.
And these non-island people had a different gene pool, meaning the chances that your children would be born deaf got more and more rare. The other major factor was a big change in access to deaf education. In 1817, Thomas Gallaudet and Laurent Clerc started what's now known as the American School for the Deaf. The school, which is located in Hartford, Connecticut, was the first of its kind in the U.S. It offered deaf children around the country a chance to live and study together. Most of the deaf children on Martha's Vineyard ended up attending. There, they learned what would become the standard sign language in the U.S.
It introduced them to American Sign Language, which was being developed in those years. It also meant that they came home speaking not only the sign language that they were used to in Chilmark, but also this new sign language that linked them to a larger region-wide, eventually nationwide, community of the deaf.
So the incidence of hereditary deafness was lessening. ASL was coming into its own. And let's not forget that oralism, where the objective was assimilation into hearing society, was still around too. All of which sadly meant the eventual downfall of Martha's Vineyard Sign Language.
By the middle of the 20th century, it was effectively extinct as an active language, even though it was still being used as late as the 1930s.
Its last native user, a deaf woman named Katie, died in the 1950s. And so knowing sign language, something that used to be so commonplace in Chilmark, no longer seemed as necessary. Growing up in the 1930s, Joan's father, Everett, remembered thinking exactly that.
I had no patience with it, you know. Another generation, it didn't make sense to me. Why do that, you know?
But as a historian, Bo takes a different view.
Chilmark and the Vineyard's reputation as a deaf utopia remains a powerful idea because it holds out at least the potential promise that things as they are not things as they have to be. I can't speak to what it would feel like to be a deaf person learning about this, but from the outside looking in, I can imagine if you'd spent your whole life feeling as if hearing society wanted to hold you at arm's length and didn't know what to do with you. The idea of a place where the deaf were embraced and welcomed as humans, as individuals, must be an extraordinarily powerful story.
Today, it's estimated there are around 1 million deaf people in the United States, and that almost 4% of Americans have difficulty hearing. More than 500,000 people use ASL to communicate as their native language. And almost three quarters of parents with deaf children don't know sign language. That's much, much different than what deaf kids in Chilmark experienced.
They grow up in homes where there's a lack of knowledge of sign, meaning that, you know, there's a barrier on their ability to connect with their parents.
Niall DeMarco is a model, actor, producer, and deaf activist. We're talking with him through his ASL translator, so that's the translator's voice you're hearing.
Oftentimes, hearing parents want their babies to be like them, which is so natural. But oftentimes that leads to, you know, the mistake of, say, teaching oralism and wanting them to speak the same way when there might be another option available.
The other option, of course, is sign language, which was how Niall grew up.
Really, long before my very first memories, I was learning sign language. I had exposure to the language from the first day that I opened my eyes. And at home, I had constant exposure to ASL. Truly, you know, sign language is my first language, even though also English very much feels like my first language in a lot of ways. They sort of run in parallel.
Niall is, in fact, fourth generation deaf. And so he was raised in a world where deafness is celebrated, not misunderstood or feared. In 2022, he wrote a memoir called Deaf Utopia. He meant the title to be provocative.
I knew that so many hearing people would see that and say, that can't be a perfect world, but what if it is? It was something that I wanted to achieve with my book. I wanted people to really read through it and understand the perspective that a deaf person has when we don't have the communication barriers. You know, now I'm able to function as a bilingual adult between two languages quite easily, and I think people should know that.
In Deaf Utopia, he tells the story about the moment his dad found out one-day-old Niall and his twin brother were both deaf. He raised his fist in excitement. He kissed his wife. He was proud. So although Niall was born in 1989, in some ways his life was similar to deaf kids growing up in Chilmark in the 18th and 19th centuries.
You know, my entire household, everyone was accessible to me. We could share ideas and we could talk about not only current events, but hot topics. And that's a very different story than many other deaf kids out there who are born to hearing families. I'm a part of a 10% quite rare subset where my parents are deaf and also they use sign language.
Niall used ASL at home and he went to a deaf school and a deaf university where ASL was also predominant. So it pretty much wasn't until he began his professional life that he was faced with a world that didn't know how to sign and that didn't know much about deaf people or deaf culture either.
It wasn't really until I got into the entertainment industry when I started to realize, oh, okay, I'm being reminded that I'm deaf every day. I have to explain that I'm deaf. Whether that was hearing writers, directors, or producers, I'm in a smaller minority that is expected to very much assimilate with society's design that was really built for hearing people.
It makes him wonder, what if some of that Chilmark culture had seeped into the rest of the country?
I wish that everyone knew some basic sign language. Oftentimes, I wonder, what if every hearing school out there required some basic ASL in elementary school? I think it would make such a massive difference in the lives of deaf people, but more so in how hearing people perceive us and our community and how they interact with us every day. And that's huge. I mean, it really just, it helps humanize us in many ways.
That's why the story of Martha's Vineyard sign language resonates so much with him.
I remember when I learned about it, I really had wished that that tiny island was sort of like the whole United States, because I thought it must have been amazing to have hearing people choose to learn sign language instead of speaking with other hearing people. It's a great example of how you can build a culture within a community that's really for everybody.
It's a sentiment people on Martha's Vineyard share as well. People like Beau and Joan and Jane Slater. Jane is 92 years old now, but as a child in Chilmark, she regularly interacted with some of the last members of the town's deaf community, like the ladies who would stop by her grandmother's house to chat.
I just remember the women sitting around talking and being able to understand a little of it. The grandmother taught me how to say, hello, come in, sit down, she'll be right with you, and that kind of stuff. And then they would always try to get me to talk to them, so that was fun. They'd get you into the conversation. I did not know that that was unusual. I mean, I don't know when I became aware that people were interested in that, but I do feel lucky that I was born early enough to still be part of the Chilmark that included some of the Chilmark deaf. They really were a part of the community, and there was no awareness of them being different. And I think that really made Chilmark a special place.
I have to confess, as a child, I was one of those like Midwestern child who just thought that Martha's Vineyard was
an actual vineyard. And I think in my mind, owned by Martha Stewart.
Same. Yep.
So this has been illuminating for me in many, many ways.
Learned so much this episode.
I've just learned so much this episode specifically.
I also loved how a person's worst accident becomes their sign language name. Like, that to me was wild. Like, dude gets his hand lopped off by a thresher. All of a sudden, everyone mimes losing a hand. Like, yeah, that's Benny Mayhew. Like, can you imagine that? We will remember you by your trauma.
I like the mention of Gallaudet School for the Deaf. I have a quick Gallaudet School for the Deaf story. I almost told this when we were at the Super Bowl because it's a football story.
Ooh, lay it on us.
So I played on the club football team in college at Duke. And that,
wow.
Don't picture college football. Picture like idiots on a playground.
Too late. I'm picturing that you played
pads.
For Duke.
There were only like three other teams in the region that we would play. And every year we would go up to Washington, D.C., where Gallaudet had a team. And they were like a legit football team. And again, we were not. And so we got crushed. I think it was 44-12 and 46-14. But the thing that happened both years, which amazes me, every time when they wanted to hike the ball, they would beat a big drum and they would feel the vibrations and they would know that's how to go. And by the end of the game, we had all become accustomed to this. And one time they went on the second drum beat both years and we all dove off sides on the first one.
That's amazing. I absolutely love that story. Getting your guys' asses handed to you by a drum beat. Also, like, I was thinking about when I was in high school, one of my best friends, he taught me sign language, but just the alphabet, right? And then there was a bunch of cute girls in his history class, and they also spoke sign language. So he like was able to like win over all this favor with them by helping them. He was really smart. So he would cheat in history class, and they would be sitting there doing sign language, and the teacher had no idea. So when I saw them doing the secret languages, I was like, oh, I've seen that. That totally works. So yeah. Oh, by the way, if you'd like, I cast this one as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah, please.
So if you guys were curious, I did. It took me a second because I was like, well, how would I cast this? Who feels right for Martha's Vineyard other than Martha Stewart? So I went with, for Joan Poole Nash, I thought Mary Steenburgen just seemed right, right? I don't know why, it just seemed right. And then for Bowen, the historian, I thought Michael Sheehan. Right. I don't know why, but Michael Sheehan just felt right for him. Right. And then for Niall DeMarco, keeping that vibe, I thought Barry Keoghan. Right. You get this cool deaf activist. He seems like I had got integrity. And then finally, for the 92-year-old local, Jane Slater, I thought, let's give it up to a legend, Carol Burnett.
Anytime Carol Burnett's coming on screen, I'm happy.
Right. And you know, she used to do sign language every episode of her show, but it was a specific little sign she gave to her. I think it was her mother. And she would always signal with her hand to her mother at the end of every episode. It was like their own little sign language. So I thought, boom, we got to honor that.
This is perfect. Zarin, you did it again.
Oh, thank you, Dana.
Very Special Episodes is made by some very special people. This show is hosted by Dana Schwartz, Zarin Burnett, and me, Jason English. Our producer is Josh Fisher. Today's episode was written by Joanna Sokolowski and Julia Smith. Additional writing by Marissa Brown. Editing and sound design by Josh Thane. Mixing and mastering by Behid Frazier. Our story editors are Abby Stone and Marissa Brown. Oral History Clips with Eric Cottle, Everett Poole, Sydney Harris, and Jane Slater are excerpted from interviews conducted with Lindsay Lee, Martha's Vineyard Museum Oral History Curator, courtesy of the Martha's Vineyard Museum. Couldn't have done it without you. Original music by Elise McCoy. Research and fact-checking by Meredith Danko, Austin Thompson, Joanna Sokolowski, and Julia Smith. Show logo by Lucy Quintanilla. I'm your executive producer. Very Special Episodes is a production of iHeart Podcasts.
Looking for hair removal tools that not only deliver smooth results, but also empower you with a sense of complete control? Enter Conair Girl Bomb, your secret weapons for smooth, sleek results, made just for women. From the ultimate Girl Bomb grip and professional-grade blades, you don't have to compromise and settle for less. Conair Girl Bomb equips you with the precision and power previously reserved for men's grooming tools. So take your hair removal routine to the next level with Conair Girl Bomb. Available at conairgirlbomb.com or a retailer near you.
I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.